This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and from time to time we ask Ed Feigenbaum, who is the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters, which are produced by Hannah News Service out of Indianapolis, with us to talk about issues involving the General Assembly and about gaming issues. And that's why we have him in on today's program to talk more details now that we have the 2019 General Assembly session sine die, as they call it. They finished up. Rapidly ending, I suppose, Ed, because of wanting to be out of town in time to make sure that there are enough motel rooms for the National Rifle Association people. Just the same, thanks for being with us today.
Glad to be with you, Chris.
We note that there's one of the most important measures, not the most important measure, that's come up in the General Assembly session, the one that involves, of course, the two-year state budget is the most important. That's the one that has to be done. But it looks like that the House Enrolled Act 1015 is probably one of the most important bills that probably hasn't been decided yet, at least as far as the governor's concerned. We know that Governor Eric Holcomb has the measure before him, but he's taking a little bit of time, I understand, to do a little more deliberate reading, some due diligence, as it were, I suppose. Tell us, first off, what the things stand as far as the gaming omnibus bill, as it's also known, and more in more detail, why the governor may be taking a very close look at the actual part of the bill itself.
Well, you've got it right, Chris. The legislation is still pending on the governor's desk, waiting for a signature, but there's really no indication that he won't approve it. I think that the reason that he's taking a little bit more time is he doesn't want to appear to be particularly anxious to sign it, and he's come under a little bit of fire for some of the favors that people perceive he might have received from one of the casino operators who have benefited from this bill. And he also, I think, understands that this is considered to be expansion, and while the legislature now and the people in the legislature today don't view expansion in the same kind of negative context as they might have 10, 15 years ago, you know, there's still some people out there in the state of Indiana that are a little bit reluctant to expand gambling. And I think he doesn't want to be perceived as being too anxious to sign this.
I know that in particular, the major sponsor of the measure, Todd Houston, said no. He was one of the few members that definitely said no at the end of the session, that he couldn't go along with it. I guess he had his concerns about the measure, but do you think that they'd be the same or maybe different from what the governor might have?
Oh, totally different. And Representative Houston ended up voting against it because one of his core principles was that we shouldn't be making these, what the speaker calls cross payments, what everybody else refers to as holding harmless the communities that may potentially be losing revenue from the current casinos to any kind of casino shift within either the city of Gary or with Terre Haute against, for example, Evansville and French Lick, or from the two racinos, the Anderson and Shelbyville racinos, potentially impacting the casinos in southeastern Indiana. That was Representative Houston's concern. But one of the really interesting things to me, Chris, was that if you look at the folks who did vote against the bill in the House, you saw that it was the sponsor of the bill, the chair and vice chair of the House Committee on Public Policy, and the chair and co-chair of the House Committee on Ways and Means that were among the opponents of the measure there. If you told me 2 weeks ago, a month ago, whatever, that those individuals would vote against the bill and the bill would still pass by a very comfortable margin, I would have told you, you are crazy.
Is there any thoughts that you have had about this while you've watched and listened to the entire process here, going all the changes that have been made as to why is it one of these measures? It has such a strong economic development aspect to it that it overshadowed all the other issues?
Well, I think that there were two views of this bill when it was introduced. One was that it was just too inclusive, that there were too many things in it and it would collapse of its own weight. And the other perspective on that was, well, there was so much in that there was something in it for everyone and anyone, and that there was no way that it could fail to pass because there was something that someone could point to as being advantageous to his or her district. In the end, I think people took the perspective that the House Majority Floor Leader, Matt Lehman of Bern, who was a sponsor of the bill in the House, took. And he said, look, he said, half of this bill really is a major benefit to the state of Indiana, and half of it doesn't, as he said, set well with me. But he said, if you look at things as a whole, and if you look at why we're here in Indianapolis voting on different bills, he said, we are here to vote on things that benefit the state of Indiana overall, benefit them as a whole. And, you know, every piece of legislation we can find fault with, and this one, to me, he said, has more of a benefit to the state than a detriment. We're bringing in more money than we would otherwise on a net basis. We're bringing in economic development to Gary and to Terre Haute, and these net benefits to the state outweigh individual potential losses to some communities. I think that's the perspective that individual lawmakers ended up taking, except for those in a few particularly balkanized districts where, you know, things were particularly acute. For example, with Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon from Munster, and also for, I'm trying to remember the other one from Northwest Indiana who voted against. I guess it was Carolyn Jackson voted against that. But if you look, the others did vote for it, including Earl Harris and Chris Chung and Reagan Hatcher, and I think they understood that, you know, there were positives and negatives to their districts, but overall it was best for Lake County and the state of Indiana.
And I know, too, that even just in recent days, Dan Carton with The Times had a story online and in print talking with the Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr., who very early on offered his concerns, regrets that the city of Gary was working so hard to get the Majestic Star Casinos relocated. But even though he fought against it very strong, tooth and toenail, I guess, as the phrase goes, he says he has not only no regrets about his efforts, but he congratulated the city of Gary for making it through.
Absolutely. And the Horseshoe Casino Hammond will probably be above the kind of revenue level that will not allow it to qualify for most harmless money. But I don't think that in the end, Hammond's going to be affected quite as much as potentially East Chicago. And there were some special provisions made for accommodating East Chicago, both the city of East Chicago and potentially affected employees at Ameristar. And Representative Earl Harris saw to that, and the Senate made sure that particular amendment that he proposed and gotten through the House was continued in the Senate and included in the Conference Committee report.
Yeah, Mayor McDermott mentioned about the fact that he hopes that the city of East Chicago gets as much benefit out of the holds harmless provision that's in the measure, because they're the one that he says is that they're definitely going to be affected by the matter of the casino change to location wherever it happens to be in Gary.
Absolutely. And then you look at some of the other hold harmless agreements that were in there, including one for Evansville, where one legislator told the Vandenberg County legislators, hey, look, you know, you're not going to be worrying about the loss of revenue from a Terre Haute casino in a few years. You're going to be worrying about the loss of revenue from a Kentucky casino, you know, coming online sometime soon. And, you know, this whole harmless money is going to help you for a few years. And, you know, we're doing what we can internally, but we've got to strengthen the industry within the state of Indiana to be able to compete with the Kentuckys and the Illinois of the world.
Well, I guess we're going to be finding out here from the governor before too long. It shouldn't take him too long to go through the measure and make some decision whether he's going to sign off on the gaming omnibus bill or not. Since we have about 5 minutes left here in our conversation today, let's catch some of the other highlights of the General Assembly session. What are some of the other measures, as you choose, in the legislative session action that made it through and to the governor's desk to be signed that you think that should be noteworthy?
Well, let me just mention one thing about the governor's action on House Bill 1015, which is the gaming bill first. And that's that, you know, even if he were to veto it, which I don't think he'd do, you know, I think he'd be more likely to let it become law without a signature, but I still don't think that he'd even do that. But if you look at the vote on that, the the House and the Senate each approved it with a majority of both Republicans and Democrats in each chamber. So you had a majority of the votes of each of the caucuses approving it. So I don't think that there'd be much of a chance that this wouldn't be overridden if that were the case, and it's certainly not a partisan issue. And rather than get into individual measures, and there were just so many different things that happened this year, let me just kind of touch on something that I think was a little bit of an interesting overarching theme. And that's that I heard so many legislators say after the session and in different forums, not all just kind of coming together and agreeing in a group think thing, but individually coming out and saying that they really had fun this session. And I've not heard that from legislators in decades. It was a real refreshing attitude, even with some tough issues like the gaming thing and some divisive issues like some of the firearms bills, some of the education funding measures, the hate crimes, bias crimes law. Even with some of those on the table, the legislators individually found ways to just disagree without being disagreeable. And I think that the fact that we had an infusion of new leadership at the top of the House Democrats, the Senate Republicans, and then in the budget process in general with new leaders in the Senate Republican caucus and new leaders in the House Republican caucus as well on the budget side, made for a little bit more inclusion, and leaders in general made it real clear that freshmen were going to be included in the process this year. There were a lot of freshmen that were appointed not only as advisors in the conference committee process, but as actual conferees. And I think that made them feel part of the process, made it much more participatory than usual. And even though there were a lot of negatives you may have heard about with respect to things being decided in closed caucuses and closed majority caucuses, this really did seem to be a much more, I'm trying to think of the correct word, but people really felt that they were included and that things were not quite as difficult as they had been in the past between perhaps the caucuses and some individual members as they had been.
Well, Ed, thank you very much for spending some time with us today to go over, in particular, the gaming omnibus bill that the governor is now taking a very close look at before he decides whether he wants to sign off on it or not. And some of the other interesting points, too. We did note that there was a different change in attitude from a lot of past legislative sessions. I'm glad that you noted that as well, too. And as always, we really appreciate your comments and your commentary on these issues, and we hope to have you back on again real soon.
We will look forward to it. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you very much. Ed Feigenbaum is the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters that are published by the Hanna News Service. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, it's another General Assembly session in the record books, the history books probably for some as well. And now to find out at least one view from the 2019 General Assembly session, let's go to Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. And Lieutenant Governor Crouch, thanks for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, it's an honor to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we know that it's been a very eventful session, to be sure, and you've had a chance to make some comments about it. Fill us on how you feel that this past General Assembly session went on some of the issues and some of the things that maybe will have to come up, I guess, for study committees in the months ahead, so they may in turn come up in 2020.
I have been associated with the Indiana General Assembly for 14 years, 8 years as a state rep, 3 years as auditor of state, and now the last couple of years as Lieutenant Governor, and I will tell you that in all that time, this session, more than any other, was marked by a spirit of collaboration, cooperation, and stability. And as a result, Indiana once again passed a balanced budget, meaning we are not going to spend more than what we take in, no new taxes, and we'll also have 11% reserve. So unlike the federal government, Indiana is living within its means. Now, within that budget, there were a couple of really important initiatives that I'd like to share with you. First is education. The budget funded an additional $763 million to K-12 education. And then within that, for teacher appreciation grants to reward those extraordinary teachers. Because as we all know, outside of our parents, our teachers had the biggest influence on us. And we want to thank those teachers for the impact they're having on our young people. But also, we paid off the unfunded teacher's pension liability early, which frees up $70 million in savings for school corporations and school boards all over the state. Now, it is our hope that those school boards and school corporations will take those savings that they realize and direct them towards teacher increases in pay, because what a teacher makes is a local decision by the school board and school corporation. And we hope that this additional funding will help in that regard. There are also so many other parts of the budget besides education, although that is the biggest portion of the general fund. The K-12 budget ends up spending over half of our general fund money. But in addition, we put in an additional $4 million for workforce ready grants to be able to ensure that our workforce is skilled and ready to meet the needs of our employers. But also, we passed the Veterans Income Tax Exemption. And what this does is this phases in 100% of the income tax for military, retired military pension. Reason this is so important is we want to attract those men and women who are leaving the military to Indiana to join our workforce. I head up the Next Level Veterans Initiative, which looks at attracting some of these 200,000 men and women who transition out of the military every year and match them up with employers here in Indiana, and then integrate them into our communities so that they can call Indiana home. And this ability to be able to offer them tax-free, income tax-free on their pensions will be a major attraction in getting them here to Indiana. But I'm sure, as you know, having broadband and having reliable internet to rural Indiana is a priority for Governor Holcomb and I. And with the General Assembly's support, there is $100 million in the budget to expand broadband to unserved areas in rural Indiana. Because Governor Holcomb and I want to ensure that rural Indiana and the Hoosiers that call us home have equal access to technology in an effort to create growth and ensure quality of life. I have been an advocate for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and chaired the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Task Force, which submitted a report to the General Assembly last October. The General Assembly passed legislation to extend the life of that task force through 2025 so that we can take that report that we submitted to the General Assembly and ensure that the recommendations are enacted upon in the future. This session, the General Assembly did provide an additional $10 million to First Steps programming, which will work with those young people from birth to 3 years of age that have intellectual and developmental disabilities to help them be successful in life. And so we want to ensure that we keep implementing those recommendations. So we're really excited about the task force continuing its life into the future. And then tourism is an agency that I head up in Indiana, and we passed legislation to take our state tourism agency and make it a quasi-government agency so that the private sector can contribute and help supplement the $4 million that tourism receives from the General Assembly because we so believe in a quality of place strategy in Indiana. And we want those people who come and visit Indiana to be able to play here, but ultimately stay here. And so this ability to rev up our tourism agency and take it to the next level will mean so much to the future of Indiana. And then if I could end with a bill that is extremely important to women here in Indiana, and that was the passage of the Woman Centennial Suffrage Commission. Next year, 2020, will commemorate the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote. And the creation of this commission will be able to recognize that and to celebrate the many achievements that women have had here in Indiana over the past 100 years. So, all in all, a very good session for Hoosiers and Hoosier families.
Well, not only you got all those topics taken care of, but you got the, a 2-year state budget squeezed in for good measure too. That's a, that's an awful lot to get done in the time that you had to had in the state house. As far as you know, since you're the president of the Senate, you see it closer there. But are you and the governor aware of any study committees that may be coming up here in the months ahead to take a look closer at some items that maybe didn't get all that far during this last session?
There were a number of recommendations by the Indiana General Assembly. Mm-hmm. And what will happen is the Legislative Council, which is comprised of leaders of the Indiana House and the Indiana Senate, will get together sometime here in June. And they will actually determine the study committee topics for this summer into next year's General Assembly. I know that one of the bills that received a lot of attention that did not make it to the end was the vaping bill. And how do we address that issue? Because there have been concerns by the school corporations and by advocacy groups across Indiana about the harmful effect that vaping is having on our young people and how children in middle school are vaping. So that is one that, while it didn't pass as a study committee, I believe that and hope that the General Assembly will take up this task this coming summer to be able to make recommendations on how to protect our young people and ensure that their health continues, their good health continues as they move into adulthood. Right.
I wouldn't be surprised if you see that one get fast-tracked at the start of the 2020 session. Since we have the budget taken care of, that's already put aside for now, and I'm sure that there'll be more time to be able to look into these issues that the study committees will probably look into as well.
That's absolutely correct.
Well, once again, it's been a very, very busy 2019 session at the General Assembly this year, and we really appreciate the opportunity to find out more from Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. And Ms. Crouch, thank you very much for being with us, and we hope to have you back again to talk about some more topics that come out of the State House.
Well, thank you for having me on, and thank you for helping to educate your and familiarize your listeners with what's going on at the State House.
A lot of Indiana lawmakers describe the 2019 session the same way, that it was a quiet one, with no major blow-ups or big controversies that typically characterize the General Assembly's annual session. Indiana Public Broadcasting's State House reporter Brandon Smith takes a look at the 2019 legislative session.
Heading into 2019, most agreed on what would be the biggest issues of the session: funding for teacher pay and the Department of Child Services, major changes to the gambling industry, and a hate crimes law. Yet those issues didn't generate much furor over the session's 4 months. House Speaker Brian Bosma summed it up.
This has not been a pulling teeth session, as some are.
Take DCS. A year ago, controversy at the Child Welfare Agency was highly charged. The former director said the governor's policies would lead to children dying. Democrats wanted investigations. This year, Democratic Representative Ed Delaney says the rhetoric settled down.
I think there's an unspoken hope that the new management of DCS will be able to turn that ship around.
And lawmakers easily approved multiple bills aimed at further reforms around the agency. So let's look at teacher pay funding. Debate on the issue was ignited last year by studies that suggest Indiana is at or near the bottom of the country for teacher pay raises. Educators, like Indianapolis's Amber Seibert, demonstrated in their communities throughout session.
teachers were being expected to do more, but were being given less. And teachers are leaving the profession at an alarming rate.
There were also a couple rallies at the State House, highlighted by State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick's criticism of her fellow Republicans.
Because you and I, we all know we have got to be better than this.
But those rallies and demonstrations didn't seem to resonate in the chambers. And when Republican leaders held a press conference near the end of session with school officials to tout their education funding package, teacher representatives were absent. Still, Governor Eric Holcomb said he hopes teachers are happy.
This is a historic increase to K-12 investment.
So if DCS and teacher pay didn't charge things up at the State House, what about gaming?
Now, in the past years, we've made small tweaks to gaming policy. And when we do, or when it's proposed, everybody in the industry is running around with their hair on fire.
That's Republican Representative Peggy Mayfield. This year's bill clears the path for the state's first new casinos in a decade and legalizes sports wagering statewide. Some called that a monumental shift, a once-in-a-generation effort, or as Mayfield put it, a grenade in the middle of the industry.
And strangely enough, everybody seems to be on board.
Even abortion, the most highly charged subject in the political world, failed to generate much of a storm. This year's anti-abortion bill was met with a kind of muted resignation by even its fiercest opponents, like Democratic Senator Jeanne Breaux.
Here we go again.
And then there's the hate crimes debate. No one issue captured as much attention in 2019, and Governor Holcomb, who advocated for a comprehensive hate crimes sentencing law, urged the public to get involved.
I'm going to encourage them not to stop with me, not to just write me. They got my vote, but they need to contact the legislators that vote.
But there were no huge rallies at the State House. Republican leaders said their phones weren't ringing off the hook on the issue. And when a hate crimes bill did pass, Holcomb and the GOP declared victory, while advocates grumbled that it didn't go far enough. So why then was 2019 so quiet? Senate Minority Leader Tim Lannon has a theory. A lack of bold leadership.
I don't think this was a session where at the end of it you could say we pushed the envelope to move Indiana forward. And that's the problem that I have.
Speaker Bosma has his own somewhat tongue-in-cheek answer.
Outstanding management, thoughtful strategies, careful planning. We only had two late nights. That's never happened in institutional memory. Our team worked very hard to keep things moving, and we were able to do it.
Whatever the reason, perhaps the safest bet is that the quiet won't last. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Early this spring, parts of the Midwest saw record flooding. Don't be surprised if you don't find more flooding to happen through the rest of this spring into summer. With climate change, Indiana's winters and springs are only going to get wetter. The Purdue Climate Change Research Center says by the middle of this century, we could see up to 20% more rain in those seasons, likely leading to more flooding. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, like many living in Midwestern states, few Hoosiers have flood insurance.
Deb Guffey has had enough. She and her husband, Ray, own Brown County Tire and Auto Service in Nashville. This February marked the third time their shop has flooded in the past 10 years. Outside, employees tried to lift a customer's car out of the water and onto a tow truck. Inside, Guffey says the water in her office was more than 4 feet deep.
It came so fast. We tried to unplug what we could, and my secretary and I, Jessica, got shocked. And so finally, she just grabbed my arm. She said, "We got to get out of here."
Now the Guffeys are moving the shop to the south side of town to hopefully escape the flooding.
It's either that or close up.
The Guffey shop sits just inside the floodplain, but right now they don't carry insurance. Most homeowners' insurance policies don't cover flood, so you have to purchase it through the federal government. As of 2 years ago, a little more than 23,000 properties in Indiana were covered under the National Flood Insurance Program. That's less than 1% of households and businesses in the state. James Sink is an insurance liaison for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. On a Skype call, he says historically about 20% of flood damage claims would come from outside the floodplain. But that percentage is growing as rain patterns change.
So just because someone doesn't live inside of that special flood hazard area does not mean that they're not at risk for flooding. Low risk does not mean no risk.
So how do people find out if they should buy flood insurance? One way is to look at federal floodplain maps. Unfortunately, those maps are often out of date, especially with the changing climate. David Knipp with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources helps create Indiana floodplain maps for FEMA. He says FEMA is supposed to update its maps every 5 years, but Congress has to approve the funding to do it, so it ends up being more like every 5 to 10. Even if floodplain maps were more current, he says they're only meant to show risks from rivers and streams.
However, there's also risks that aren't mapped with these maps, more localized flooding that you'd see like in a neighborhood if you had a large downpour over a neighborhood.
And Knipp says we're seeing that kind of flooding more often. Take, for example, two neighborhoods outside Columbus. Amanda Burdine and her neighbors in Armouth Acres and Northcliff suspect drainage tiles from nearby farm fields are sending water into their homes and yards during heavy rains. This spring, Burdine's home had standing water for more than 30 days.
You have no ability to take showers, wash your clothes, go to the restroom. There were people that had to be taken out of the neighborhood in trucks by family members and didn't come back for 2 or 3 weeks.
After the last flood in 2015, Burdine fixed the damage to her basement, where her two oldest daughters sleep, and bought two pumps to try to keep the water down. It totaled $25,000.
So in January, we paid off that debt, and we got flooded again in February.
Most Hoosiers qualify for flood insurance, even if they're not in a floodplain. But not everyone can afford it. James Sink with FEMA says the average premium in Indiana is just over $1,000 a year. That's about the same amount the average Hoosier pays for home insurance. Most people who own a home in an area that floods would want both. This leaves residents like Amanda Burdine feeling stuck.
We just don't know what to do next because we don't know what's going to happen the next time it rains. Do you fix it and cross your fingers? Or do you not fix it and prepare for what will happen again?
David Knipp with the DNR says the agency is working with FEMA to find ways to more quickly update floodplain maps. Until then, residents will have to decide if the peace of mind that comes with flood insurance is worth the cost. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up in Leafield, Indiana, with my grandparents. And then I moved to Valpo when I turned 18 because my grandparents, they didn't. I'm going to live with them forever. So when we were 18, we had to move out on our own. My grandparents raised 12 grandkids, and we live in one room, well, three rooms. There was a kitchen, a bathroom, and a bedroom for the girls. So there are 12 girls. And my grandparents raised all of us. Because my parents wasn't best parents. They was alcoholics and druggies. We was almost ready to go to the state, and my grandparents stepped in and took us. With one bedroom, you know, room, it was like taking a bowl like a deli, and you go to the restroom. Then we had to wash our clothes, and then we had to go hang them up on the line to dry. And if we didn't do that, then we were going to throw the clothes the next day. My grandma said, you know, that's responsibilities. My tongue was going backwards. And they couldn't figure out why I couldn't say certain words. So like my parents, they didn't care. So my grandma took me to the doctor and it was too late. And they had to go in and clip my tongue and sew it up. Cause it was like choking me while I was trying to say words. Sometimes I like to try to go to work. I like to help people clean their houses and stuff. But nobody will hire me. They put me on Social Security because I couldn't get a job. And then I got pregnant with my daughter, Monica. And she has a lot of health issues. She has cerebral palsy and type 2 or G2. And so she's, you know, a lot of work. I took care of her on my own. She'd be 20 in September. I did it for 20 years by myself. Little dad's not in the picture. and she had back surgery and, you know, health issues. So I had to get up in the morning, like 7 and 8 o'clock in the morning, get her fed and change and her diaper change and bathe and dress. Then I had to take care of my nieces. At the time, my sister was living with me. We lived there for like 7 years, and then we went on separate ways. You know, she wasn't very good. My sister went down the wrong path, and so I just stayed, you know, away and took care of my daughter and my nieces. I was living off my Social Security check. My rent was $390, and my check was $575. And time I paid my rent and my NIPSCO, that's pretty much where my money went. And we didn't have a vehicle, so we walked a lot everywhere. And we made too much money for food stamps, so I couldn't get food stamps. My sister, she won't apply for food stamps for her and her kids. And, you know, so every once in a while she'd be nice and take them shopping, buy them groceries, and bring them back to the apartment. But we just lived at the food pantry. We go to the food pantries. And sometimes we went to the trustees, get a trustee voucher for the grocery store. Sometimes it made me feel bad, because people would stare at you. And you just feel down. You know, people talk, you know, don't you think she needs to do something, you know, for having kids? And I tell these people, these are my nieces and my daughter, you know, you just feel low, you know, you just don't have no self-esteem when you go to the food pantries. But now I think, well, you're here too, so I guess you're in the same boat than I am.
And you can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This is April, and it's Child Abuse Awareness Month, and our next guest here on Regionally Speaking, things that perhaps Indiana ought to take some major steps, more steps actually than maybe have been taken, to try to protect our youngest and most vulnerable citizens, and that is Indiana Youth Institute President CEO Tammy Silverman. Tammy, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Happy to be here.
Well, I know that all of the latest comments that you make in your recent column that's out there to take a look at have to do with some of the big changes that came about because of complaints that had been filed about the state of Indiana's child welfare program. Tell us about that, about the study that was done, and how it kind of fits in with how we're trying to make improvements in child abuse and the like.
Certainly. I think many of us are aware that there's been a lot going on at the Department of Children's Services, and such that there was enough concern and public frustration and feedback from the legislature that they commissioned an outside group to come in and do a large-scale assessment. It took about 6 months, and they came up with 20 specific recommendations, and we're seeing that those recommendations and trying to address some of those things have been a major component of this legislative session. So we're hoping that those increased dollars and some of that increased attention will result in some new interventions. Unfortunately, the need is high. Indiana right now has the third highest rate of substantiated child abuse and neglect cases in the country. So this is something that, although every April is Child Abuse Awareness Month, this April in particular for Indiana holds big significance because we have a lot of work to do.
What does state law require that be done if there is a young person who is at risk or in need out there? How's it set up, and how does the DCS get involved?
Certainly. Well, and that's a great I think sometimes we hear the word CHINS thrown around a lot, and that stands for Child in Need of Services. So thanks for bringing that up. And the definition of that is that if a child is seriously impaired or endangered by abuse or neglect, and the and is a big one, the child's parents are unable or unwilling to correct the problem on their own. So that means in that case where there's serious abuse and neglect and the child's parents aren't addressing the problem, then the state steps in. And there's a few different remedies. Obviously, the caseworker makes those determinations of what needs to happen. Does the child need to be removed? Are there some supportive services that can be wrapped around while the child stays in the home? Whatever those circumstances are. Right now in Indiana, right around 30,000 children did have that designation of being a child in need of services. Mm-hmm. And so we have the breakdown by every county on our website. If you're curious to know how your county stacks up to the state rates, you can certainly do that by just hopping on IYI.org.
I know these young people, too, also sometimes because of the situation that they're in with their families or just by whatever happened in their life, end up getting involved in courts. And the courts, I know the CASAs, which are the court-appointed special advocates, get involved, or even, I guess, some of the guardian ad litem, I guess is what they're called, can help out in this way to try and get these youngsters off to at least the right direction.
You're absolutely right. And sometimes, you know, we really champion these folks as the unsung heroes, because even for adults, court can be an intimidating place, right? But for little kids, it's critically important that they have an adult that goes with them to court that speaks up specifically for their best interest. Sometimes that's hard to do, right, for family members or for folks that don't have that great sense of what a courtroom's like. And those CASA volunteers and the guardian ad litem, it's their goal to specifically do that, you know, really, really make sure that the kids understand what's going on and speak for their best interest. That being said, there are those programs, there are CASA programs in 80 and 92 counties, and unfortunately, there's a pretty hefty waiting list right now.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who's president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. This is Child Abuse Awareness Month here in Indiana. And I know, Tammy, that you mentioned this in more detail in your recent column, talking about that we have a program that is very popular, very well-known. It's a way to help increase child well-being by making it easier to get the pre-K education that they might need. And that seems to have a bearing on all this, too. Where does it fit into dealing with child abuse and child neglect?
It does, Chris. You're right. And this is what we find really exciting. Obviously, we've been talking about as a state pre-K and high-quality pre-K, and those early Head Start programs are certainly those, you know, fit that description of high-quality pre-K. There was a recent study out that was really exciting that found that those same pre-K programs that we're saying we need to have more of in our state actually help reduce child abuse and neglect. And the reason why, and it kind of makes sense, they weren't looking for this, and it was one of those positive surprises. But it makes sense that as people have their kids in pre-K and as kids are learning kind of how do you best interact with each other and, you know, what are some of those rules that go on in a classroom and that socialization, the parents are also learning. They're learning what is normal child development. Maybe for a three-year-old it's quite normal to have a tantrum, and what do you do about that? And so it also helps those parents. It reduces family conflict. It reduces family stress. It provides more supportive parenting and home environments. So it's kind of a win-win that, like I said, nobody was anticipating that was going to come out of this research on pre-K, the value of pre-K, but it is such a great benefit because we know, obviously, as we said earlier, we have a big issue right now with child abuse and neglect cases.
Now, I know as we're talking right now about the issue of the DCS, the Department of Child Services, they're going through the budget process. The new two-year state budget is being worked on now in the General Assembly, and there are some exciting things that I guess have been proposed to help increase the funding for the DCS and maybe some ways to be able to work some funds around to make sure that the financial help is there too. Are there any other measures that you're aware of that the IYI is supporting that would go along in this effort to reduce child abuse and the like?
Well, and again, really, really making sure that we're not losing sight of that early pre-K because, you know, we know that has benefits as well as everything that you've talked about. You know, I think that we will see, hopefully, we're all hoping and anticipating that we'll see those reduced caseloads at DCS. We'll see some higher salaries. We know the salaries right now are really low. The caseloads are high, and that's producing a ton of turnover. And that's not good either for the consistency within the department or, more importantly, for the kids and families involved. So we're really hopeful about how this legislative session is going to address some of those big needs that were identified in the assessment and hopefully benefit all of our kids.
Now, we know that there is a hotline out there that if people that are concerned, if they see child abuse and neglect underway, that they can get hold of the authorities and do so and in turn get some help for the young people. Tell us what the child abuse and neglect hotline is and how people can also get more information from you folks, too.
Certainly. It's 800-800-5556. So it's 1-800-800-5556 is the Child Abuse and Neglect Hotline. It's open 24/7, 365. The important thing, just as you said, Chris, is for us to remember in Indiana, every adult is a mandated reporter of suspected child abuse and neglect. Doesn't have to mean that you know for sure. It's kind of that, do I think this might be an issue for this child? You need to pick up the phone and make that phone call. Some other folks will take it from there. It's also important to note that reports can be anonymous. So really, it's really up to all of us. Our laws say that we're all responsible for looking out for our kids. Obviously, at IYI, we believe that, and we work on that every day. And if you need more information, we're at IYI.org.
Well, Tammy, thanks for being with us today to talk about the subject on this month of April, which is Child Abuse Awareness Month. Talk with you again soon.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Tammy Silverman is President and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute.
And now, as National Poetry Month comes to an end...
I'm Robert Pulido, President of the Poetry Foundation, and this is Poetry Now. Today's poet is Katherine Wagner. Her new poem, The Moon Has a Head But No Body, dismantles common tropes with a long engendered history in poetry.
My boyfriend was somewhere not around, and I had heard the coffee maker go off and was grinding, and I had texted him, bring me some coffee. And he didn't bring me any coffee. And so I just kept on writing and feeling quite horny. You know, the moon has all these associations with it, feminine associations, right? Like Philip Sidney has that wonderful poem, with how sad steps, O moon, thou climbst the skies. And it's a poem about a cold woman who won't sleep with him. And at the end of the poem, he says, do they call virtue there ungratefulness? Meaning, do they call not sleeping with somebody who's being really nice to you being ungrateful, as they should? You woman who isn't sleeping with me, you ungrateful, you know what? The moon has a head, but no body. So why assume she is a woman? Inconsistent binarists. Assume she is cold. Why not assume drunk? Legless. Can keep up pretty good, though, with your car in the rural night. You are a passenger, your left leg lolls, and your friend reaches a hand across the emergency brake, which points now at the base of the gear stick shaft and can point at its head, but nowhere else. Thus does not speak. And unless overused, abused is reliable, whereas anyone can misunderstand or willfully misinterpret, the point and represent are very different. Moon. 6 a.m. and the snow sent enough light upward for this window to transmit and permit my seeing. I heard more than I saw. I understood less than I heard. I was well-read compared to, but not compared to. I begin to feel warm in my crotch as if a wadge of moist electric blanket were stuck in there, and my friend was not riding on the other side of the brake. I mean emergency. He is not fox hunting and on a horse in a novel in which the brake is a strip of greenwood. He is downstairs. The coffee is made, but he ignores my text. He works alone, and I will have to go down there. The way that I feel about it when I read it is super irritated. I'm like, but it's also watching out the window over snowy Buffalo and seeing the moon there kind of over the highway. Moon! 6 a.m. and the snow sent enough light upward for this window to transmit and permit my seeing. Rhythm is absolutely essential to the way that I write anyway. It isn't really necessarily an oral game anymore, but it is for me. You know, when I look back at poems that I loved when I was a kid, I loved Edna St. Vincent Millay's Renaissance and that part of it where it goes, and I could push the grass apart and lay a finger on your heart, or something like that. And I just love being rocked and rolled that way. You are a passenger, your left leg lolls, and your friend reaches a hand across the emergency brake, which points now at the base of the gear stick shaft and can point at its head. You know, you notice a wadge. It's kind of a gross word, I guess. He is not fox hunting and on a horse in a novel in which the brake is a strip of greenwood. He is downstairs. The coffee is made, but he ignores my text. at some point, I like to gather a batch of poems and feel as if they're focused around maybe some set of questions. But there are long phases when I just don't have a clue. It's kind of just part of it. You have to have terrible doubt, radical doubt. I mean, you never know what the hell you're doing, right? You never know what you're doing.
That was Catherine Wagner with her new poem, The Moon Has a Head, But No Body. To learn more about Poetry Now, please visit our website, poetryfoundation.org. For Poetry Now, I'm Robert Polito. This is the WFMT Radio Network, Chicago.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we continue our conversations with members of Northwest Indiana's legislative delegation, and we'll also have a special conversation with the man who created the C-SPAN networks. Hope you can join us.